It's the first Saturday of the month, which means it's Doctor Surgery for our wellness segment, a general Q&A with Dr. Charles van Lochrenberg, joining us until just before 8 o'clock to answer your health-related questions. If you're looking for some advice, a bit of reassurance, maybe a second opinion, you can give us a call on 021 446 0567. You can drop a WhatsApp to 072 567 1567 and an SMS to 31567. And please, would you give us much information as possible? It enables Dr. Charles to not have to just guess randomly. it allows him to point his medical expertise in a particular direction. So age, sex, location, or location on the body. Morning, Dr. Charles. Good to have you back with us.
Hello, it's so great to chat again.
Good, good, good. Right, let's dive straight on in. Somebody has sent in a message saying, what are the signs of a stomach ulcer and how is it diagnosed in the absence of a scope? Also, comma, anything I can take over the counter. It feels like really bad hunger pains.
Yeah. That's a great question to start off with. So, I mean, ulcers, as most listeners will know, we're talking about an erosion in the stomach wall or potentially a little further down, and it causes significant discomfort. That erosion is really the protective lining that looks after the inside of your gut. It protects you against your own digestive acids, right, which are really potent. They make pool acid look like a sort of homeopathic. They really are strong.
Sure.
That's why the ulcer can cause such discomfort. So causes are quite varied. Sometimes environmental can relate to diet, smoking, for example. Often there's a link to a particular bacteria, strangely enough, which kind of skips to the end. Often the treatment includes actually quite a simple antibiotic to nuke the bug that is predisposing that erosion area. The symptoms that your listener would have been potentially complaining about, it's essentially indigestion amped up, right? So
right.
It's the feeling of discomfort and fullness around meals, discomfort particularly around certain foods, and they vary depending on the person, but often sort of acids and other foods that are aggravating the lining of the tummy. And maybe just a sort of a sensation of reflux, particularly in the evening or after a meal when someone's lying down and posture changes a bit, right? To make a diagnosis without a scope, it's a little bit like we're hunting blind, right? So we kind of do need to have a look. That's the best way to definitively kind of have a peek. And that's not a complicated procedure. Your surgeon or your gastroenterologist can essentially pop down a thin tube with a camera and actually have a look. But before that, we can kind of get a really good idea just clinically, asking the right questions, getting a range of symptoms, and maybe we might even do a trial of therapy, which would include sort of reducing the acid levels in the tummy. We've got medicines that can do that, and that antibiotic that I referred to, and then we sometimes see if we can get relief.
Is it something that people can get over and over again? I mean, are some people more susceptible to a stomach ulcer than other people?
Yeah, for sure. Okay. There might be a bit of a genetic link, point one. There's always something, you know, it's always something in your genes that predisposes to a certain type of behavior in the gut. But usually it's a combo. You know, I always sort of sit on the fence and go, it's a combination of factors, and then people roll their eyeballs and go, well, can't we just have one? No, it's a combination. So it's sort of like your predisposition plus lifestyle plus diet. Body weight's got a little bit to do with it. And yes, so recurrence, if you haven't removed any of those treatable bits or removed the bug, then yes, they certainly can recur.
Okay, there you go. I hope that helps. Thanks very much indeed. Oh, this is a great question. This is a fantastic question. Thank you, Marlon. If we don't need an appendix, why do we have one? That is such a great question. I remember being at school when I was, much, much younger, probably around the age of about 10, and there were at least 5 or 6 kids in my class who, over the summer holidays, had managed to all have appendicitis and all had their appendix out. And to my knowledge, they're still very much alive and kicking 30-something years later. What is the point? Why do we have one then?
Well, you know, they're these big questions that we probably don't have all the power to answer, right? Some of it, so the master plan, right? So there are some bits and pieces in your body that are a little bit more difficult to explain than others. And appendix is one. I mean, I suppose you could say wisdom teeth are another. A few sort of vestigial organs that don't appear to have a heck of a lot of use, and they very often just cause unpleasant symptoms, and we ultimately remove them, right? And the appendix is a great example. Remember that the appendix, which literally tells you what it is, a little outpouching on the lower gut wall, that and it contains lymphoid tissue. So it's a lymph gland, not dissimilar. You know, lymphoid tissue sits in your tonsils, sits in other places. So it's part of your immune system, fighting system. And there is a school of thought that says that the lymphoid tissue in the appendix is part of producing some of the special antibodies that we need to survive planet Earth, right? So it's not a totally useless organ at the get-go, but because your body's got a whole range of lymphoid tissue, we certainly can't do without it. So there we have it. It is a little bit of an unnecessary, but it probably does have a vestigial, if I can use that word, immune system function.
It's 7:43, first Saturday of the month, which means it's Dr. Surgery with Dr. Shal van Lochrenberg. If you would like to send in a question or give us a call, you can do so. 021-446-0567 is the number that you need if you'd like to speak to Dr. Shal directly. Or alternatively, drop us a WhatsApp, 072-567-1567 and 31567 on the SMS. As much information as possible, please. Question for the doctor. How can oral thrush in an adult be treated?
Quite simply with an antifungal is the short answer. So depending on what the cause is, common causes, typically where your immune system has been dropped to fight that fight. For example, you're on antibiotics is a common example. And then quite easily we use an oral antifungal. Sometimes we might have to go a little bit stronger, so sort of systemic tablets to help fight the infection. Try and identify what the cause is, what precipitated it, whether it's a mooty that you're on that maybe we can change, but certainly treatable. The sort of bottom line with fungal infections, whether it's something as simple as a candida, which is thrush, or some of the more complicated ones, particularly ones that we get on the skin, not so much in the oral mucosa in the mouth, they can take quite a long time to treat because they're quite stubborn bugs, funguses, and so we sometimes have to treat them for quite a long period of time, so days and weeks as opposed to just a couple of treatments.
Okay, there we go. Another question about thrush or potential thrush. I'm breastfeeding my 5-month-old and have a burning sensation in my breast during and after feeding her. I Googled and it said it could be thrush. What can I do? As it's agony, but I'm not ready to stop breastfeeding. Thrush in the breast. How does that happen?
Yeah. Not actually uncommon, and it can be something that's bounced between baby and mom, so one never really knows whether it's chicken or egg, right?
Right.
It's a little bit backwards and forwards. Now, I'm outside of my wheelhouse in terms of heavy-duty, ask me a cardiac arrest question.
Yeah, get the missus on. She's good with boobs.
Something simple, like a gunshot chest.
Yeah, exactly.
But the sort of sensible doctor memory says, number one, don't panic. Number two, if you're concerned, check with your healthcare provider just to make sure we've got the right diagnosis, because there are many other disease entities that can cause pain in the breast, particularly around breastfeeding. But if it is a thrush, which is quite common, the general sort of thinking is switch to the other breast as much as possible, give it a rest, certainly express milk to keep the milk flowing.
Right.
And it can be a topical treatment, sometimes almost a homeopathic type treatment, which might alleviate it, but they will settle. So it's typically an express on that side, feed baby from the other side, and let it settle down.
So from the breast that she's expressing from, is that milk still safe, or must she just dump it?
Typically that gets discarded.
Okay.
Just because once again, you don't, the milk is fine, but it's really the potential contamination on bottles and on the actual units, right? And so once again, we end up playing ping pong with the candida. So generally, I'd test that if we've got plenty of milk and stick to the other side.
Okay, got you. Morning, my knees are wobbly and I can't stand upright without falling over.
Good Lord, that sounds like me after a long run. Knees are wobbly. We probably do need a little bit more info, but if we're talking about something that's arrived suddenly, then we're thinking about a recent injury or activity or trauma. If it's something that's developed over a period of time, then we might be looking at something sort of more musculoskeletal. Maybe the person has damaged a ligament in the past, or there's an arthritis condition going on in the knee. Quite difficult to say. Wobbly knees, we're really talking structural, right? So it's the skeleton that's bearing. So a wobble is often one of those elements, and the knee is quite a complex joint. It does a lot of hard work. So if in this case, we're probably going to say we need a clinical examination, right? So toddle off to doctor with wobbly knees. And the fact that it's both the knees suggests that maybe there is an underlying condition, maybe an age-related or disease-related condition that's troubling the person, and then get it checked out that way.
There we go. Thank you very much indeed for that. Lee's message in. Morning, Lee. It says, morning, SJ. Please, can you ask the doctor, what can I do about my aching heel? It throbs constantly and I feel something hard. Please, it's unbearable. Ow. And I'm saying ow because I relate. I've just had to have a whole x-ray story with my foot. So I'm with you, Lee.
Right. Well, here we go. So now, lack of information. Thank you, Dr. SJ. You need more data. So the person didn't say whether they'd injured it initially, sort of like a stand on a stone or a step or something. So that could be the cause. And then it's just a long healing process. We're talking a bruise, right? Or we didn't say whether we're a high activity person, a runner, for example. And that's quite common. So think of a condition like what we call plantar fasciitis, so, which is a fancy name for inflammation of that bowstring tissue that sits under the sole of the foot, that's part of your spring walking mechanism. And it's quite commonly although the structure is inflamed, the pain is felt in the heel, right, as you where you stand on that heel bone, which is your calcaneus. That's a dreadful running injury to have. I've had it a number of times, and it really takes some time for that inflammation to settle down. The clue for the plantar fasciitis is if that pain is worse on initial standing in the morning. So in other words, you've had time overnight for some of those microfibers to start repairing. Not enough, because it's just hours. And then as you get up and you stand and you wait there, excruciating pain.
Agony.
And then it settles down as time goes on through the day. That's often an indicator of a plantar fasciitis. Let's say we've jumped to the right diagnosis by fluke here. And if that's the case, then it's really about reducing activity, you know, get off it during the day if possible. Those compression socks, compression little stockings for sleeping are sometimes very helpful. Some people have described great relief getting a compression, which just helps that tendon sit in the right place overnight. But it may well be that the person is off running for a couple of months.
Thank you very much indeed for that. The thing, Lee's saying she feels something hard. What would that be? Bone. I mean, bones don't inflame, do they?
Logic says not really. It's more just a distorted sensation. So,
right.
If there is something that we're feeling, then we think foreign body. Stood on something, piece of thorn, piece of something that's still there. Then you know, you'd get a sense of a object in the heel. We do get other things. There's a thing called a calcaneal spur, which sort of tells
Haglund's
you
deformity.
Little bony outcrop on the either from a chip or just natural variation, and that little bony fragment can be the trigger, if you like, for the discomfort. We'd pick that up on an X-ray or a scan if we need to, and it might not require treatment. It just might require just sort of TLC over time. You know, decent shoes, get a proper pair of running shoes again if it's a high activity person, and that's the way to manage it.
I had a foot x-ray because I've been having issues with my foot as well, Lee. Apparently, I've got osteoarthritis in my foot, which is always a thrill at 43 years of age. But I tell you what, the x-ray that I had done, I've never had such a comprehensive x-ray done in my life. This way, that way, I had to stand up on a set of steps and then this and that. I was terribly impressed. I wasn't that impressed with either the bill at the end or the prognosis. Apparently, I'm in line for something called Haglund's deformity, which is as odd as it sounds. I've got horny feet, as it were.
Well, it does give you a sort of a conversation point if the hobbits come for lunch, I suppose. beyond that, you become aware of how precious your feet are when you get discomfort in them, right?
Absolutely.
Because they just keep on trotting along, right?
No, absolutely.
But, you do get an ache and pain, then one does have to manage them quite carefully.
Yeah, hobbling along at 43 is not a good look. Oh, gosh, we've got lots of questions to get to in 5 minutes left. Right. M says, hi, SJ, I have a terrible problem with vasomotor rhinitis, which means I have a permanent runny nose like my mum. I stopped dairy for a while, which didn't make any difference, and have a cortisone spray, but it doesn't seem to help. Tissues everywhere. I hope the doc has a fresh idea. Gosh.
It's a bit tricky. Unfortunately, let's say the doc doesn't have a fresh idea. Let's stop there. What she talks about, it's vasomotor rhinitis, right? So it really just, it's a fancy word for saying that we don't think it's allergic. That's
right.
What we're saying. So it's sort of, because most sort of runny noses without a disease process, we blame an allergy, and that's quite common. So in this case, she's got a persistently runny nose without an obvious response to allergy remedies. And it's really going to be hopping around between particular therapies to see if we can dry things up. It might still be an undiagnosed allergy, and that's often still the cause. It's hidden because there's so many proteins out there that can bug us. So in this particular case, yeah, it's really going to be the sort of Sherlock Holmes approach. One by one, eliminate potential triggers and see if we can get a little bit of relief.
Is it? I mean, that just must be absolutely infuriating. And Em mentioned that she stopped dairy. I mean, would that have just been a kind of perhaps I'm allergic to dairy and therefore I'll eliminate it type thing?
Yep.
Right.
It wasn't a bad idea, right? Because there's quite good correlation between dairy products and causing just excessive mucus in sort of urban dwellers.
Right.
So that is a useful button to push. The fact that it hasn't helped at all is really just taking one card off the table.
Okay, got you. Hi, Doctor. A group of us returned from hiking in the Eastern Cape a fortnight ago and four came down with, we think, tick bite fever afterwards. Now all on antibiotics. What can you tell us about tick bite fever? Best treatment, says Jay in Takai. Oi! Sorry, Jay.
Oi. sympathy, having actually had tick bite fever from an excursion in the Eastern Cape. So I feel the headache from here. Tick bite fever is caused by it's a bacteria. It's caused by a goodie called rickettsia. There are a couple of them. It can cause quite a nasty infection. So, you know, it presents with headaches, particularly general sort of even flu-like symptoms. Does need to be treated, but it can get complicated. The fact that the diagnosis was made is fabulous. You know, that they've just gone a couple of weeks post the trip. It normally takes sort of 10 days to 2 weeks to manifest. And relatively easily treated on the correct antibiotic, which is typically a simple one called doxycycline. It's in the tetracycline group of antibiotics. So thankfully, if the diagnosis is made on the antibiotics for a week, 10 days, and should be good to go.
Okay, there we are. I think we've done ingrown toenails on this segment a number of times, but sadly somebody's messaging saying they think they have one. It's too sore. Any advice?
Yeah, it's about sort of podiatry, good foot hygiene in the sense of, you know, manipulating that. We try and avoid the whole sort of mini surgery thing now, where it used to be quite the thing to sort of put some anesthetic in and actually cut down the one line of the nail to remove that aggravating edge. It doesn't really stop the recurrence. It's more around just gently getting the nail bed or the side nail out of the tissue, making sure you're treating any local infection by keeping it super clean, even like alcohols and strong stuff to keep that that area clean. Make sure there's not a sort of a persistent sharp nail digging in. And sometimes we almost have to sort of prop it up with a little bit of a swab or something gentle to just keep the nail separate from the skin. And then very careful footwear so that you don't aggravate it again and push it down. And then they generally do resolve. But if it's not improving, pop to see your general practitioner and they'll sort you out.
All right, there we go. And at 7:56, that is it for Dr. Surgery. Dr. Shah, great to have you back with us. Thanks very much indeed. Have a wonderful rest of weekend. Thank you to those of you who sent in questions for Dr. Shah. I'm so sorry we couldn't get to all of them.